Hello, listeners. Yavar here. We just wanted to offer a brief editorial note that the following interview with Jonathan Frakes was recorded on July 12th, just before the Actors Union, SAG-AFTRA, joined Hollywood writers in striking for fair treatment and fair pay. The details of the strike include language which prohibits participation in new interviews promoting current content such as Star Trek Picard. While we at the Goldsmith Odyssey normally avoid weighing in on politics of the day, our podcast is almost entirely focused on Hollywood, and we regularly welcome honored guests like Jonathan Frakes who work in the industry. In our view, this matter isn't about politicians, political parties, or government. People are joining together in this collective action to be able to make a living in this industry and have proper credit and compensation for their creative work and likenesses. Even if we didn't agree with the goals of this strike, and we do, we will always respect our guests and the positions they are in, not just to show respect, but because we genuinely do respect them. We felt the intensity of the situation and the timing of our release necessitated a statement that Jonathan's generous participation in recording with us was fully above board before the strike began. We hope you enjoy our chat. And welcome to a very special installment of Odyssey Interviews. I'm Yavar Marathi, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, David.
Hi.
And Clark.
Hello.
And also joining us today is Lucas Kendall, publisher and creator of Film Score Monthly. Welcome, Lucas. Glad to finally have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Lucas actually helped put us in touch with our special guest this evening, a man who starred on 7 seasons of probably the most famous and beloved television series to feature a Jerry Goldsmith theme. He both starred in and directed 2 of the 4 theatrical films which followed that series, collaborating directly with Jerry, who provided some of his finest late career music. Jonathan Frakes, welcome to the Goldsmith Odyssey podcast. We are so pleased and honored to have you join us.
Thank you. I apologize for my late arrival as a Luddite.
No worries. Let's just lead off by asking you what you remember your first encounter with Jerry Goldsmith or his music being. Was it on Star Trek or something earlier?
Oh, I think I was listening to Goldsmith all the way. Did he not write Chinatown?
He did. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And in Goldwyn's office, there was a very bizarre, obscure, small movie that I remember that he did. Anyway, I told many people this. My experience on Star Trek was great. And when I got to do the movie, that was great. But the coolest, kind of biggest Hollywood part of directing a major motion picture for Paramount was the fact that Jerry Goldsmith was the composer. So Rick Berman and I went to his house, and he had a studio upstairs above the garage. He lived in Beverly Hills, of course. He had gorgeous fucking white hair and a ponytail at his spectacular home. Hot, smart wife, style, grace, elegance, everything that you would have hoped. He was like totally not disappointing. And we went up into the studio and schmoozed and had tea or coffee or something. And he said, I've been working on a couple of things here. Let me see what you think. And he played us these samples off of his, what would have then been, what, a synth or a keyboard or a, it was 1996. So I'm not quite sure what equipment he would have been rocking at the time, but it was just him. Joel wasn't there. His son wasn't with him. So he just pushed some buttons, and we heard the beautiful music that he used under the credits.
Mm. And was this your first time meeting him?
This was my first time meeting him. He had been, you know, he was a get. Because he had done a number of the, obviously, you know, the number of the original series movies, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
He did 2. He did the first and the one Shatner directed.
The 5th.
Yeah. Anyway, I was touched by his talent, his grace, and he lived up to what I had dreamed, which is someone who did this. I sort of understand a lot of the other parts of the process, if you will, I understand a little bit about acting and directing and staging a scene. And I've been around cinematographers so long, I sort of get some of what they do. I don't understand the math, but I understand costumes, I think, and props and production design. But the idea that a composer, a great composer, can write something that literally makes the scene, the show, the movie, the event, the moment, whatever it is, better, more interesting, different, it's still beyond me at 70. How you have that talent, that particular creative instinct that you can translate from watching something and feeling it and then telling us how to feel it even more or even differently by virtue of the tempo, the melody, the voices of the, you know, what instruments are used, the rhythm, the speed, all the things, all the elements. I played trombone. I played badly, but I've been in bands and orchestras my whole life. So I know what music sounds like. I know what it feels like to be in the middle of making music. But the mystery of the person who writes the music for movies and for TV shows that make our shows better is, and he's one of the three greats, one of the two greats. I mean, what is Jerry Goldsmith?
Well, for us, he's the great.
But yeah.
Most people would put him on the top five at the very least.
Yeah,
I think.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So given your musical background, I'm wondering what your initial instructions are like when you're talking with him. Did you have a sense from the beginning with First Contact or with Insurrection of what you wanted in terms of musical themes and placement from the start? Or was that something that was largely left up to his instincts?
That was largely left up to his instincts. He and Rick and I and Star Trek in general and those kind of genre movies have a theme. There's a theme for the ship. There's a theme for the Borg. There's a theme for the nemesis, if you will. Insurrection, there was a theme for the love interest, the story with Patrick and, her name just went out of my head.
Anish, right?
Anish, exactly. Very nice pull.
You got three gorgeous new themes, you know, from Jerry for Insurrection. It's really impressive how much musical material he delivered for that one, I think.
I thought the same thing because he was tired. And I remember, I'm not sure if it was Insurrection or First Contact, but he had given some of the cues to Joel to do. Was that First Contact? Yeah.
Yeah.
But not on Insurrection, as I recall.
Yes.
The themes, he, like that first day I mentioned with when Berman and I went to his studio, he had seen the footage or some of the footage and he had created themes. And there was not much for either Rick or me to note, if you will, in terms of changes. What we did do sometimes was adjust the end, adjust the start, which is so important and can change everything.
It makes a difference when a cue enters and exits.
Oh, it's massive. Does it enter on the reaction? Does it enter before the reaction? Does it cue the reaction? Does it and a badly placed cue, I'm sure, can ruin the moment or break any surprise or elegance that the moment has or gives you. So Rick is really good at it. I got better and better at it. And Jerry, in spite of his sort of, we had put him on this pedestal, he was very accessible and very, he wasn't dug in. I had the privilege of working with Hans Zimmer, who not only didn't write the music, but was very dug in, even though he had his staff do all of his writing on Thunderbirds. But he was an immovable object, it felt to me.
Oh, wow. Not malleable. You couldn't really work with him.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but he certainly thought and knew that he knew better. He thought this is, you know, first of all, and I could be speaking out of school, it felt like I've got so much to do. I don't want to be changing this cue. I never got that kind of disrespect or toss aside from Jerry. And you know, this was Star Trek 8. It wasn't like he was working with Zemeckis or Spielberg. This was a first-time TV director on a show that he was loyal to and attached to and famous for. But he could have done what some professionals or some artists do, which is kind of walk through it. I know how to do this. And he didn't. He didn't strike me as that kind of person.
Communication was important to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's collaborative.
Did your background as a musician help in your conversations with Jerry? You act like it's kind of a mystery, but I feel like you probably had greater insight than a lot of directors who worked with him who didn't have the musical background.
It helped in that I understood the sound of the horns versus the sound of a baritone, or the sound of the clarinets versus an alto sound, you know, the subtleties and the differences of the things that he used to change. I'll jump right to when we go to the scoring sessions, which you guys have probably all had the privilege of seeing at some point or another, which is really kind of the most exciting, next to watching Alfre Woodard and Patrick Stewart duke it out in First Contact about Moby Dick. To be in the scoring session with, you know, Jerry Goldsmith conducting and his ponytail waving in front of you through the glass, and then he'll stop and he'll think, and you can see him just scratching a little bit to score. Okay, I'm going to take, you know what? I don't like that on the trumpets. You guys, could you give that part just there from 23 to 27? Let's just give that to the horns. Okay, let's take it back. Now we'll go back to 15. And he starts in, and you know, the orchestra's so facile. They pick all this shit up, and that changed in the instant that he said it. So you get to 23, and all of a sudden, no longer the trumpets, but it's the horns. And the horns, as we know, bring majesty or whatever the horn sound is. And the whole cue changed. And he knew by changing the instrumentation of one section of one part of the cue from one instrument to another would do that. And that blew my mind.
Did you feel like anything advanced further with Insurrection or because it was the second time around, or do you look most fondly on First Contact with him?
I was more comfortable because I could call him Jerry and I recognized him and he pretended to remember who I was. But I used to love to go to the scoring stage and just watch the players, and they all worshiped him, and they That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, Seth still does it. Seth is so very loyal to real musicians on the Orville.
But yeah, and you can tell. You can hear it.
Yeah, you really can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You really can.
I have an insurrection story you might not have heard.
Do.
Okay, so this comes from Richard Kraft, who's Jerry's agent. Richard went over to Jerry's studio when Jerry was starting on Insurrection, and he was scoring the same setup, you know, the keyboards, and he had the whole opening of the movie when they're chasing Data. And they're watching it with his amazing music, but all the visual effects are incomplete at this point. And so at a certain point, Richard says, excuse me, like, what's going on here? And Jerry said, I have no idea.
Yeah, that's honest.
I wondered, Jonathan, maybe you have some insight on that, how much he did seem invested in that world, because he seems to have given some kind of conflicting answers in interviews over the years where sometimes he's like, oh, I don't understand any of that.
And then when it came to Star Trek, which is really, I guess, the basic premise of Star Trek, I never really understood all the stories, to be perfectly honest.
And then other times he's really very moved by the idea and spirit of Star Trek as a series.
I want to ask you a bit more about your techniques, but I thought perhaps we'll have another piece of music from the motion picture Star Trek. Was this something you were pleased to be asked to do?
Oh, yeah, I love doing Star Trek. You know, those are fun. There's no violence in the films. They're all very idealistic. They're romantic. And there's action and there's relationships and all of that. It's fun to do.
That's a really good question. I wish I had a concise answer. My impression was that he was part of the Star Trek family and part of the Star Trek legacy. And part of him was very proud of that. And we who got to work with him were kind of the beneficiaries of it. I don't know that he was particularly invested in the franchise or in the genre. And that, for instance, our dear Sherry Lansing ran the studio at the time. Remember her?
Remember the name, yeah.
Sherry Lansing was the president of Paramount. And she, when we were about to do First Contact, she had, she had us in the office, but she had said to Rick Berman, honey, I don't know anything about this franchise. I'm very grateful that I have it. So whatever decisions you want to make about the director, et cetera, you go ahead and make, because I don't understand anything about Star Trek. So I thought that was quite revealing. Would also probably help me get my job. So I think Jerry, do you get the feeling that he was somewhat proud of being part of the family? Or
I've gotten the sense, at least, and maybe you guys have too, in the interviews where he's a little more dismissive, that it's rooted more in his humility more than anything. Oh, I don't understand any of that, you know, so for my head sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well,
was that real?
I think it was. He was two different things that are sort of contradictory. He was vain and he was shy.
Yes.
You know, he wanted the attention and the adoration, but he was also afraid that, like, if you liked him too much, he was rather suspicious. He was like, who are you? You know? So I think he really liked having the Star Trek theme to kick off his concerts.
Yes.
He loved being, you know, having this mainstream, accessible, beloved institution that he was a part of. But I don't think he was not there sitting like thinking, wow, I wonder how they're going to defeat the Borg this time. He didn't give a shit.
He may not have seen the whole movie. Let's go there.
I think it wasn't about the nitty gritty plot details. Like maybe he wouldn't follow all of that, but he got the essence. He got the, you know, the spirit of Star Trek in a lot of ways. I think he connected with that.
Yeah.
And he liked that. Like the reason you can say he's contradicting himself is there are more interviews where he sort of dismisses it, but then you'll get the one where he speaks really eloquently about what Star Trek really is, about the hopefulness for the future and the way the characters treat each other. And to have that kind of understanding means you really actually do get it.
Space is a very romantic thought. I mean, it's to me, it's like the Old West, only we're up, you know, in the endless universe. And it's just about discovery and new lives. But I do know that it's really about goodness. I mean, about a better world is where we can live in peace and tranquility with one another. And it's a lovely thought, and I think that's why the universal appeal of it.
I've always felt Star Trek as being very romantic, very lyrical, and which basically, if one boils down the whole premise of it, that's what it is.
So when you went to Star Trek directing school,
right,
and they sent you to the editing room and to learn about post and everything,
right,
and you went to the scoring stage and you watched Dennis record?
Oh, did I?
Do you remember? You don't remember which one it was.
I don't.
Your first three episodes were scored by Ron Jones. Ever make it to one of his scoring sessions?
Yeah, I used to go to see Ron Jones, but Dennis was sort of like the godfather over there. They were all, and I don't know if he set it up that way or if Berman set it up that way, but it felt like it was McCarthy's world, and the other two composers were alternating. It was like alternating cinematographers under some big DP.
Hmm.
Does that seem like an accurate assessment?
It is. They tended to rotate until they got multiple shows. And then Dennis, because he was so fast.
Yeah.
And I think Rick liked him aesthetically the most. And Dennis was a little bit older, mm-hmm. and he was like the senior guy, and he was just so cool and easy to get along with that he really was. And he had scored the pilot, he had scored Farpoint.
Yeah.
So he was like the senior man. He's a great fella, and he's a very interesting guy.
I'm a huge fan. And what about these guys who are now working on Picard?
Oh, yeah, spectacular music.
They bumped what's his name, who had done Discovery and God, it says
Jeff Russo.
Yeah, they bumped Russo. Actually, Terry Metalis bumped Russo and moved Barton in. Yeah,
and then they brought Frederick Weidman in too much for one person to do in a certain amount of time.
And then they stole from Jerry.
Yeah,
that was something I wanted to ask you about, because you had said once that, for you, the biggest difference between TNG, the show, and the movies was Jerry Goldsmith's score and the grand beauty of that music. But hearing basically a more cinematic approach applied to Picard, as you say, often in style of Goldsmith and sometimes paying homage to him directly.
Yeah.
Was that something that made a big difference in that series for you?
I think from the time JJ rebooted the franchise with, what was his composer?
Michael Giacchino.
Giacchino. The entire Star Trek world became more filmic, if you will, and has continued down that road, probably because Alex Kurtzman, who had worked on those Star Treks with JJ, was trying to continue the path that we had. So, and also because they were given, $10 million an episode to make a television show, which seems absurd, but And you at least you see it on the screen, but it blows my mind.
Oh, you sure do with Picard season 3.
Oh.
That's like 10 movies.
Yeah, and a lot of that credit goes to Jerry Metalis. He believed so hard and he knew so much about the canon and the lore and the characters. I never had better stuff to do as Riker than I did in season 3 of Picard.
You were never better, by the way. Acting.
He will rise.
Yeah.
You said on the call that the delivery was touch and go.
Well, we were on the Titan, of course, and they hailed me. From sickbay, you better get down here, sir, right away. The tone of voice, it was not what you wanted to hear. It took 17 seconds to get down there. The longest turbo lift ride of my life. I thought I was losing him. My unborn son. His whole future flashed in front of my eyes.
And in that moment, you became a father.
That's right. And everything you've read in the books and the poems about fatherhood goes right out the window the moment you see your kid. He's so small and so fragile. You just know that you gotta take care of them at all costs. You'd burn the world to save them.
I am so very happy for you, Will.
I hope one day you get to have this feeling too. Nothing like it. Oh shit.
I was never older either.
Well, your character finally got to grow up some, right?
Yeah, I think that's true.
You had arrested development before.
Exactly.
You know, after season 3 in some ways.
Grew up in a wise way. I mean, it's similar to what Marina did, whereas the series went on, the 7 years, she let more of herself be Troy instead of the affectations they made her do.
Yes.
And she just got, you know, like, oh, she's a British accent now. Good for her, and isn't she lovely?
Yeah.
And you kind of did the same thing with this, where there's a lot more of Frakes in Riker than the character as defined by the first 7 years of that series.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Marina's horribly underused as an actor and in our show. But boy, when she's there,
yeah,
she's such a powerful, wonderful presence.
She's so weighty, especially in the Picard shows and all of them. She's really, really weighty in a good way. I'm just like,
yeah,
she says things and it matters immediately.
Yes.
You had it coming.
Easy there, Imzadi.
Do you have any idea what that young woman's been through? What she's going through now? What the Romulans did to her? To you, the idea that all this could be some kind of subterfuge or simulation is preposterous. But to her, it would be more of the same. You know you're real. But she has no reason to believe that. She has no reason to believe that she herself is real. Her capacity to trust was a flaw in her programming. She's been manipulated, tortured. Her very consciousness has been violated.
What I need to be...
You need to be Jean-Luc Picard. Compassionate, patient, curious.
And one other thing, useful.
Let us help you, Jean-Luc.
And the great thing about Picard 3 is that it's like you say, okay, we've got all these characters. What conversations do I want to see two characters have? And they're all there. They're not all running around. They'll sit in a room and talk about something that has needed to be talked about for 25 years. And it was all there.
Yeah, I had the same feeling that we were certainly in a better place than we'd ever been. And my wife, who never watched Star Trek with me, watched season 3 and said that the characters all had entrances that were earned that helped to tell the story and to solve the problem of the amazing Amanda Plummer character. You know,
oh gosh, yes.
The characters came in at a time where we needed Geordi's help or we needed Marina. And it's hard to plot 10 episodes that successfully.
And I appreciated the entrances were spaced out.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, everybody's getting together for Frontier Day in the first episode. We're going to get the whole crew back together and celebrate. And that would have been the easy way to do it. But being given 10 episodes.
And I think that's what Patrick feared. That's exactly what Patrick feared when he first signed up for the show and said, I'm sure you've heard this story. I was actually in Maine. He called me on the phone, but he invited everyone to dinner to essentially say, I'm doing a show. It's called Picard, and none of you are in it.
except for you, Jonathan, and you, Marina, for a couple episodes. Well,
but that was not his intention.
That happened later.
That happened later. The great Michael Chabon was on the show and pitched this idea, and I guess they persuaded Patrick that, maybe if I did go to visit Riker, it would be okay. Uh-huh. And that opened the little crack in the door. But he, for better or for worse, wanted it to be not about the Enterprise, or not about Next Generation. And then when he was convinced only by the end, and he's been very generous with his credit to Terry in the press lately about how wrong he was, that it wasn't the reunion that he feared. He feared what you just said, that we're going to go to Career Day and everybody's sitting around the table. And it was, or not Career Day, what do we call it?
Frontier Day?
Frontier Day. Career Day. I do want to ask a couple more music questions, but just really quick, I have to pay you a compliment on directing the best scene of the entire season and probably the series. Basically, you got to do the Jaws monologue, your version of it.
Oh.
Like Todd Stashwick, obviously amazing actor.
Unbelievable.
Stole every scene he was in, even when he didn't have lines.
Yep.
But your directing in that scene, like the sound design and every element was working.
You must have heard about the Battle of Wolf 359. 40 Federation starships up against one Borg cube. Yeah, I was just in engineering. Just a grease monkey. And the next second, it's like space itself was burning. 50 of us made it down to the life deck. But there's this one life pod, 10 seats. But the thing is, we were all friends. They were all my Jack Crusher. We didn't fight over who should live and who should die. We waited for orders. And then finally, some lieutenant comes down and she just starts barking. You. She's pointing at me. Just some dipshit from Chicago. Now I'm lucky number 10. Chinyam count herself. Get in, she says. That's an order. I know. I ask myself the same thing. I shouldn't make a mistake.
I'm sorry.
11,000 dead. Do you know where your old man was on that day? He was on that Borg cube, setting the world on fire! Forget about all that weird shit of the Stargazer. The real Borg are still out there, and they have a name for you. Locutus of Borg. The only Borg so deadly, they gave him a goddamn name.
All right, that's enough.
No. No. It's all right.
It was... that made that my favorite episode of the season, I think. That's episode 4. There were a lot of good things about it. It was very Star Trek-y in a lot of ways. But kudos to you on handling that so deftly.
You're very generous. It might have been the best episode of TV I ever did.
Oh, wow. You did some pretty good TNG episodes.
I did some pretty good TNG episodes. But this had, and those that little two-parter, 3 and 4 I did, and 3... ended very sort of down, and 4 ended up bringing us all right back. And then those babies, those weird space babies, were born. But to have that Jaws scene with, and Stashwick had been, he was so ready.
Yeah.
Because well, Terry wrote Shaw for Todd.
And named him Shaw for a reason. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we were given enough time. My first AD, Maria, gave us enough time to do the scene properly. I cleaned up all the stuff that I could with Ed and Patrick. And then I staged it in a way, you don't know how long Shaw's been sitting there. That asshole could have been here and listened to the entire conversation for all we knew. Because we never saw that end of the bar until we heard his voice.
Did your mother already tell you this story?
Well, actually,
what a harrowing tale of survival. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt family time. I may be a little out of sorts. Your mother's pretty liberal with those pain meds. But speaking of harrowing stories, did your old man ever tell you about the time that he and I first met?
I was thrilled. And also, because we had time, I didn't have to cut and paste Todd's performance together. So he was able to perform that piece, that's aria, which, you know, that's the best part of Jaws. And Jaws is one of my favorite movies of all time. And the idea that that little scene that takes place inside the belly of the boat is the best scene in the movie, it just blows my mind.
I think it's the best scene in modern Trek.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the really cool thing is that it actually improved on the way a similar scene was done in probably my favorite Star Trek series, no offense, but Deep Space Nine. I love Deep Space Nine, and there's a scene between Picard and Sisko in the pilot where Sisko is similarly aggrieved over Wolf 359.
Welcome to Bajor. It's been a long time, Captain.
We met before.
Yes, sir. We met in battle. I was on the Saratoga at Wolf 359.
And you topped it. You really topped it.
Picard is in the pilot of Deep Space Nine?
He is.
He is, yeah.
In
the meantime, I will do the job I've been ordered to do to the best of my ability, sir.
He's handing over the baton or giving the show the imprimatur or whatever it was at the time. The first new Star Trek while another one's on.
Boy, how greedy was Paramount to do Next Gen, Deep Throat 9, Voyager, and Enterprise. Back to back to back to back to back to back to back.
Yeah.
Well, usually overlapping.
Oh, yeah.
Usually from the time Deep Space Nine was on, there were two at a time for a while.
I mean, if Law and Order can do it,
yeah.
You know, I don't begrudge Star Trek. I think that was a pretty good era for Trek, honestly. And going back to it, I used to not like Voyager at the time, but now Voyager has risen in my estimation quite a bit. So I think it's aged well, all of that.
I'm going to have to go revisit. I never saw much of these shows, but I'm told they're wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
I almost got thrown off the scoring stage of LA Confidential. Because he hated my fanzine. So that was the scariest moment of my life.
He knew who you were, though, didn't he?
He goes, Lucas, you've written a lot of shit about me.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. And he's like, you can stay. And meanwhile, he's like chain smoking. I'm dying.
Oh.
I met him backstage after a concert once and just chit-chatted about how bad Damnation Alley was, which that was him speaking. So he was nice and frank and uncomfortable with having people around who you would call fans.
Yeah, he didn't. He seemed incredibly humble.
Yeah.
In spite of it. But he was vain as well. Was he not? Nobody looks that great and works on that hair and is not vain.
Yeah.
But didn't he used to be called Gorgeous, or he had a nickname or something? Starting out, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, Jonathan, I think you nailed it. I used to think of him as a blue-collar maestro.
Really?
Well, yeah, because he had a very, he had a real workaholic, you know, he's a depression kid.
Yeah.
And he, in fact, he told his agent, who I got to know, in the old days, he was on a weekly salary. That's how he did all the studio pictures. And then when it transitioned later and he was getting paid like 10 or 20 times what he used to get paid, but it was per movie. He would ask his agent, could you please take the money and just dole it out to me weekly?
Wow.
Because he wanted to feel like he was working. Like he wanted to earn his keep. And he got very restless when he didn't have a picture.
I bet.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness for all of us. And he lived a long time, did he not?
He was 75. He had.
He did not live a long time.
No, he was sick when they were doing.
Yes.
He was sick when they were doing Nemesis, yeah. And he had cancer and he died. His dad lived to be like 100.
Yeah, that's the story. I've shared this story with you about his father, have I not?
No, please do.
Oh, a dear friend of mine who just died, who wrote My Favorite Year.
Oh, wonderful movie.
I love that movie. Yeah.
And Blazing Saddles. Norman was a friend of Jerry's, and Norman was a friend of the family. And when Jerry's father was dying at over 100, is that accurate?
Yeah, he was an architect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Norman Steinberg. Steinberg was asked by Jerry, who was sick, as you mentioned, in his 70s, to speak at the funeral before people come and sit shiv and all that business. And Norman, who's a comedian, said, I'll do it for you, but I've got to open with a joke. And Jerry apparently said, whatever, it's going to be great. My dad loved you. And so Norman Steinberg allegedly said in front of the gathered mourners, what was his dad's name?
It might have been Arnold. Do you guys know?
Arnold, yeah.
Morris?
I believe Jerry. That's
Morris. Morris. Yeah.
Morris Goldsmith just died. He was 106. Well, he was asking for it. Norman tells it much better, but it was, what a wonderful, ballsy, great, and it's connected to Jerry. So it was I worship Norman and love Norman. I miss him. So I love that he knew this guy who was such a significant part of my fanboy career.
Jonathan, I'll tell you one other thing that his agent told me. And mm-hmm. He said this publicly, so I'm not speaking out of school. But as Jerry was ill, they tried to do an oral history. They really wanted to get down his memories of everything.
Right.
And Jerry had the most exacting recall of everything he ever did as far as who he liked on the movie, who he hated on the movie,
what
he was paid for the movie,
where
he scored the movie. He remembered everything, but if you asked, why did you write that theme that way? He would just say, I don't know, I heard it that way. He could not articulate himself creatively, but as a clerical matter, he had a phenomenal recall for everything.
Was that true of all of his work?
I think so. He was very uncomfortable in a lot of interviews because if you said, well, why did you write, why is the Star Trek theme in 6/8? I don't know. I heard it that way. I heard it in threes, And he didn't really have an intellectual process that he was comfortable expressing. And that was consistent through all his movies. He was very instinctual and he was an incredibly studied person, but he was sort of like a prodigy. It just came out of him, how he connected to the films. Something else about him is that late in life, I think he became very interested in lighter movies, and I think he got a little sentimental creatively. But he had been, and this is also something that's known, an alcoholic, and he was, and he got in the program in the late 80s.
Yeah, he was sober. I knew that.
Yeah.
But was he inspired? Was when he did things like Alien and The Omen, and they all feel like they were genre movies, and they are. He's most famous, I guess, for these big movies, and probably was looking to do something like actors always say they are. I'd love to do a light comedy.
That is true.
Yeah, he got really enthusiastic about the smaller projects when he could do them.
He wanted people pictures. He was asked to do The Poltergeist and The Heads Exploding, and he ended up, because he was very loyal to... I personally think he didn't always have the best judgment in material. He picked a lot of weird projects that I don't think were befitting his talents. Not yours, not nothing, but some of the more, like he would also, he had a, his career was so long that he started out being the kid and that the directors like Bob Wise were all like father figures. And then at a certain point they became contemporaries. And then at a certain point they became like the relationship with you where he was probably 20 or something years older than you. So he was like the father figure to the directors.
Yes.
But he tended in his career to stick with his cronies well past the point when they were doing viable movies. So like George Pan Cosmatos, and there are guys who just had these sort of long, hacky careers. And he ended up doing like three ripoffs of Alien. And then he got very cranky about it. Like, why am I scoring this picture? I already scored it when it was called Alien.
Yes. Yeah. So did Robert Wise bring him to Star Trek?
I think so. That's the story, right?
Yeah, they were close friends. They didn't collaborate that many times.
Well, they did the Sand Pebbles, and so yeah, Bob Wise. I think so. I mean, it was like one of the very first things was like, let's get Goldsmith on this.
And yeah, he was one of the first hires in that production, before there was a script and all that.
So folks, we're through our allotted time.
Guys, I should go downstairs. I promise you.
Okay.
I appreciate being invited. I wish I had better Goldsmith, but he was, in fact, the high point of my making of First Contact. And I love that you guys kind of honor him on this show. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us as well, Lucas.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We appreciate it.
Adios.
Folks, you've been listening to The Goldsmith Odyssey, and this is a podcast where Yavar, Clark, and I cover all of the works of Jerry Goldsmith as chronologically as we can, which is very hard to do because we keep discovering new things, and interviewing people who worked with him, and that's why we had Jonathan Frakes on. But we cover the music, we play the music. We've already got a podcast on Star Trek The Motion Picture. What else have we got that they should listen to based on this?
We've also got interviews with other directors who worked with Jerry, such as Paul Verhoeven.
Joe Dante.
I spoke in 2019 with Star Trek composer Brian Tyler. He scored a couple episodes of Enterprise, and he kind of overlapped with Jerry in some ways. So that's another good one to check out if you're a Star Trek fan.
Cliff Eidelman.
Yes, Cliff Eidelman. Star Trek The Undiscovered Country was the second interview I ever conducted.
He's great, too.
He is. He's wonderful. And we're going to have one pretty soon with director Jonathan Kaplan. So, yeah, go check out those interviews. And if you enjoy dipping your toe in, dive into the deep end and go through our chronological journey, starting with episode zero through the works of Jerry Goldsmith. If you're a Goldsmith fan, I think you'll get a lot of insight from it.
Or just pick something you're interested in, like a Twilight Zone or, you know, whatever floats your boat. But you are going to hear music in our show.
Mm-hmm.
Twilight Zone's probably the most well-known thing we've covered at this point.
So far, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider writing us an iTunes review or Apple Music review, as it's known now. It really helps a lot of other people discover the podcast. And please share this episode with your friends.
And if you have any thoughts, comments, questions, concerns, anything else, you can send us an email, mail@goldsmithodyssey.com.
Jerry Goldsmith's music certainly helps.
So true.
Succession.
Boy, did they score tonight.
Oh, I love that show.
It was the best thing. It may be the best show ever. I like it better than I like The Wire or The Sopranos.
It's incredible.
Wow.
Oh, and what about that theme? What about that crazy,
yeah,
clunky piano.
Nicholas Britell's music on that is some of my favorite TV music from the past few years.
It just sucks you in like a magnet.
And he really picks his spots. It's very sparingly scored show, but whenever
it's
he
sparse,
enters,
I was
yeah,
gonna say
it's perfect.
It's sparse, but very important. Yeah.